The Red Lamp District, Episode 4. What does it mean to be a Christian? Part 1. Welcome to the Red Lamp District, Episode 4. What does it mean to be a Christian? This is the topic of today's discussion.
Ooh.
Chris, what's up? Are you doing the owl impression this morning?
No, it's the mini Ric Flair.
The mini Ric Flair? Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Is that like a wrestling guy? Is that
who
that is?
Man. Ric Flair?
Do I look like somebody who used to watch a lot of wrestling here? A lot of live studio wrestling?
Maybe. It was big with my neck of the woods. Anyway, Ric Flair, yeah, you got to watch the...
I kind of know who Ric Flair. He had like...
He ran for president last time.
Long blonde hair?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is he dead now? Did he die recently?
I don't know. Okay. Maybe. Some of those guys died.
Some people die sometimes. That's what Chris is trying to say.
Yeah.
So it's possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Playing the game of probabilities here.
Have you ever seen the... I think they're called 30 for 30. It's like a...
I know it. I've seen one or two of them.
There's an amazing episode on Ric Flair.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you got to watch it.
Amazeballs? Is it? Is that how amazing it is?
Yeah.
I like when people say amazeballs. That one always cracks me up. When people are like, amazeballs. All right, whatever that is. Whatever those are.
That's the first time I've heard that.
You never heard somebody say amazeballs?
Ever.
It's kind of the cool thing to say instead of amazing. It's the cool exclamation.
Is it a Generation Z thing?
I don't even know. I can't keep track of all them generations. I don't even know what generation I am.
Yeah.
I don't either. After the baby boomers, it's like, who even knows? Who even knows?
Yeah, history ended after the baby boomers.
Yeah, gosh. It's all post everything now. Mm-hmm. All right, so... Yeah, well, we'd like to start things off by talking about something that's kind of been... So we're going to get to our main topic, which is what does it mean to be a Christian? But we always like to start things off by talking about kind of something that each of us has, you know, been thinking about, like reading or listening to or watching or just something else that's kind of like an oddity that's been on our mind or cultural item that's been on our mind in the last week or so. So you want to go first or me?
You go first.
Okay, I was going to suggest we... Yeah.
You want me to go first?
Well, no, I was just thinking we could like randomize it somehow and flip a coin or or do...
What number am I thinking, one or two?
Well, that's not fair because you can change it.
I'm not going to change it. I promise.
Well, let me trust you on that. Let me trust you that you're...
I promise I won't change it. I'm thinking of the number.
I might be doing a podcast with a psychopath here. This is first thing in trying to mess with my mind.
Yes. It's all going to happen.
Why don't we just do paper, rock, scissors? Because that's something we can both objectively see.
Don't trust me.
That's what Greta and I always do on the Tolkien podcast. Check out my Tolkien podcast. Tolkien Road.
Yeah.
All right.
Ready?
Here we go.
Wait, it's on... I forget how we did this. On shoot after three.
We go rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Right? Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
Oh. Done.
All right.
You go first.
Me first. All right.
I did the scissors people.
I wasn't prepared for this. All right. So I thought you were going to win. You know, I can't remember if I talked about this last time, but I have just been on a real kick of like mysterious happenings like in the world, like mysterious events that have happened. Hmm. And so I think maybe last time I mentioned, I may have mentioned Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World podcast,
which
I really like. So it's a great podcast. You should check it out. And I think it'd be cool to have him on sometime. But the thing is, like, there's all these, you know, it's a pretty new one. It's only got like 40 episodes or so right now. So, you know, once you get into a podcast, you kind of can...
That's still new.
You can kind of binge, especially for me, because I kind of sit down and I'm in front of a computer all day, so I can just listen. I'm just listening to stuff all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, he did this thing on the Skinwalker Ranch out in Utah, which is just fascinating, all this like weird, just like phenomena that happens in this one little place.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's all like, it's just all kind of, it's like all of the things, all of the paranormal things, like decided to have a meetup just like on this one place. And they're like, let's all go hang out here and mess with people.
Right.
It's like UFOs,
weird
creatures, ghosts. floating orbs, portals to other dimensions.
Nice.
You know, just like it all like happens
slime,
there.
Ectoplasm?
It's like an amusement park of the paranormal or something like that. So
man, somebody's making bank.
Yeah, like weird substances like slime, you know, like yeah, so and no one's making money off of it. Like you think like somebody's like, but no one's making money off of it. But anyway, so he did one episode on that, and I was fascinated by it, and I like bought the book, and then I found this other podcast called, it's basically similar to what he's doing, but it's by some folks that aren't Catholic, and it's called Astonishing Legends, and I think that's right. Yeah. Astonishing Legends. So I just like found it yesterday and,
interesting,
but they've been around a little longer doing that than he has. So they've got a lot more episodes, but they do
similar
like
thing or
yeah, some very similar thing. They do like multi-part episodes on like the Skinwalker Ranch. And, so I just started listening to that yesterday, but they also, did you ever see the movie, Mothman Prophecies?
No, but I can see the cover of the VHS tape.
Yeah, man,
mind.
That movie is something else. Like it's it takes place in Virginia, in West Virginia.
Okay.
And it's about this it's based on loosely based on these real events that happened in like the late 60s in this in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, I think is what it's called, or Pleasant Point, West Virginia, or something like little town in West Virginia.
Huh. You've seen the film.
I have seen the film.
Yeah.
And but this bridge across the Ohio River actually collapsed in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But around this collapse of this bridge, there was all these reportings of like just weird people showing up. And like, and one was like this creature that people started calling the Mothman, and like a bunch of people saw him.
Ew.
But it wasn't like clear whether he was friendly or not. Right. He may have been friendly, like warning them about this impending disaster and everything like that. And so anyway, I'm listening to that part of this podcast now. They did like a multi-part thing on this, so I'm in the process of listening to that. But one thing, when they did the Skinwalker Ranch episode, they had like this thing like, what does it all mean? And so it was interesting to hear this from guys who aren't necessarily coming at it from with a strong Catholic background, because basically they wind up with all these phenomena, and they're one of the things they throw out there is they're like, maybe this is like just maybe the reason all this stuff is just so weird and it's hard to kind of make a pattern out of it is because there literally is just like it's like because the Skinwalker is basically like a Native American trickster, right? Mm-hmm. Like okay. You know what the trickster is from like folklore
different
kind of stuff,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
So it's this ancient thing that a lot of ancient peoples believe like had stories about were tricksters, and you can almost think of them as kind of like demonic sorts of intelligences that would like they like to play tricks on people sometimes in a really malevolent way, sometimes in a kind of benign way. But they're basically they come back to it and they're like, maybe this is really some kind of a trickster, and it's just this is the modern understanding. It just likes messing with people, right? Like, you know, maybe there's not like this like sinister like kind of organized modern conspiracy like we might think of it, but it's just it's literally just something that's like you know,
collapsing bridges.
Well, that's the Mothman thing is different, but the Skinwalker the Skinwalker Ranch is like maybe it literally is just like some kind of spiritual intelligence that likes messing with people, right? And it's all good. Yeah, Chris was concerned that the recording had stopped.
No, it's just inching along there.
Well, yeah, because it's I'm the audio engineer here, man. Trust me.
Sorry, I didn't know my place. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. That's happened before. I've been talking and it just stops.
The best things you've ever said were not recorded.
I know. The greatest lost tracks of all time.
Yeah.
Man. So yeah, I've just been eating that kind of stuff up. But there's also, you know, there's also really interesting events that have happened where it's not all like super like so spooky that it can't possibly be explained, all like events like there was this event, and I'm fascinated by things that happened in the big vast wilderness of like Russia. I like big vast wildernesses. So like, you know, the Skinwalker Ranch takes place in Utah, which is kind of a wilderness area of Utah.
Yeah.
And then I really like both like Cold War era, like Soviet history, but then it's also fascinating to think about all the, like as big as that country is, all the land that's fairly untouched. Mm-hmm. So there's this thing from the late 50s called Dyatlov Pass, which is a really interesting thing about this group of nine hikers who, like, they were, like, experienced hikers, and they just decided to go on this hike through the Ural Mountains, and they all just, like, disappeared. And their bodies were found, but it's, like, there's all these weird phenomena associated with them. Like, what in the world happened to these people? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they're just like, they were found in different places, and they, like, with, like, in a blizzard, like, they all ran out of their tent in a blizzard and, like, had to cut a hole in the tent in this blizzard, and no one knew, like, what, like, when they finally found them, they're like, why in the world did they run out with, like, barely any clothes on into a minus 30 degree blizzard?
Right.
You know,
and you're done, you're toast.
Yeah.
Not toast, but frozen.
These are all, like, experienced hikers. So that one's really interesting, but I think that one's, actually explainable by a very, like, mundane thing. And, but no one knows for sure, like, what really happened.
Yeah. Remember that film that came out that was really freaky, like, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago? It was all filmed, like, on these handheld cameras with these campers.
Are you talking about the Blair Witch Project?
Yeah, the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally remember that. Yeah. I remember, saw that in theaters, and it freaked me out, man.
I don't know if it was 25 years ago, but maybe it was.
It was. I think it was somewhere around there, because I think it was maybe closer to 30.
Mm-hmm.
No, 20. No, it would have been like 20, because I think it came out in like 99 or 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Let's check it out. Hang on.
18.
Yeah. Anyway, you wanna talk about something?
Yeah, man. So, yeah. So I've been reading a short story.
Uh huh.
Because I finished the iRobot.
Oh, nice. What did you think overall?
I thought it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the guy, like we noticed, wrote so prolifically. I think he could have spent more time on each book.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting read. I mean, it was whatever. But I'm reading H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, nice.
I've never read any of his stuff.
I have never read any of his stuff either, but I know he's like a revered science fiction author, and like almost like writes kind of like horror science fiction.
Yes, man. Really, really strange.
Yeah.
Talk about the strange and the, you know, he's capitalizing on, like, you know, mixing science with the occult and, you know, the strange and the bizarre and the creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really good writer. Very strange story, but sticks with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really sticks with you. He kind of built this whole mythos sort of behind it all, sort of, you know, talk about fantasy. It really is a work of fantasy. Wow. It's just like one fragment of it.
Yeah.
But it reminds you in a way, you know, if you're reading Tolkien and you know, sort of the dark side that he kind of brushes up against, this sort of focuses on the dark side in a way.
Mm.
If you're going to compare it to Tolkien, I mean, I think his myth is something about these two, like thousands of years ago, there's these two warring intergalactic, interdimensional armies. And they battled for the control of the universe.
Hmm.
And so humans are here, but we're sort of irrelevant. But we do have some role to play to, like, wake up these sleeping interdimensional monsters.
Oh, wow.
And so there's these servants of these people. They don't really understand what they're involved in, but it's like occult stuff. So he's mixing sort of the religious and the occult and the science fiction type thing.
Yeah.
Worth reading.
If
you like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've actually wanted to read some of his stuff. By the way, Blair Witch came out in 99. So let me look this up, because I'm thinking of this particular. Yeah, here we go. So, Cthulhu.
Yeah, that's the myth.
So there's this, like, you'll sometimes see this kind of iconized character Cthulhu, which is like has this like octopus head.
Mm-hmm.
It's got like, you know, this head with like tentacles on it and everything. Yep. So I'll see that around sometimes and.
Mm-hmm. Which has been repeated by different authors. It comes up in pop culture a lot. Like,
right.
Has a life.
Yeah, I'll have to check out. So what are you reading by him?
The Dunwich Horror.
Is that like the place to start?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just found it in a book on the shelf.
Oh, okay.
You know those books you can buy at Costco for like $15?
Yeah.
They're like, you know, hardbound with a ribbon.
Uh-huh.
And like gold edged or whatever. And they're just like collections with like a scholarly introduction of, like, I guess mostly books or stories that are outside of copyright.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, cheap to produce.
Okay.
This is one of those collections.
Nice.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I might have to check out some Lovecraft. What a great name, by the way.
I know.
You know, if you're going to be like, some people are just born with famous names. I wonder if that's his actual name. Let's see here. Let's see. It looks like it. No, he actually had different pen names. That's funny.
He had the perfect pen name, and he went out elsewhere.
Howard Phillips Lovecraft. First of all, you know, like in that era, you pretty much have to have, you know, the first two initials have to sound really good together.
HP.
Right? Like, you know, CS, or at least three, like JRR, right? Mm-hmm.
Three is good.
And then Lovecraft, man. What a great last name.
Yeah.
So.
I know. That's why I gave my son the initials. I gave him three. WGL.
Uh-huh.
Like Wiggle.
Nice.
Yeah.
WGL Hackett.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right on.
I think it could work.
Nice.
For whatever he chooses to do.
Awesome. All right. Yeah, man. We got weird stuff on our minds.
I know. What is that?
Weird stuff's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of why we're doing this podcast. Well, we're talking about something that maybe seems more mundane, but, you know, I think that this is a really, like, you know, interesting topic, and I'm hoping I could even see this being something we revisit from time to time as we go forward. What does it mean to be a Christian? And, like, increasingly, I think it's weird to be a Christian,
right?
In our culture for a long time, it was the normal thing, but it's increasingly weird, I think, to be a Christian for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not just going to be about the weird today. We're going to explore just that question: what does it mean to be a Christian? And it's a huge topic, so we could come up with, you know, there's any number of ways to answer it. But you know, the first thing that comes to mind for me, Chris, is snake handling.
Like at church every Sunday.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we do.
Yeah.
So we snake handle.
It's like an essential part of the faith.
That's basically, yeah.
It's important.
I mean, that's, you know, when people first saw Jesus, it was like, he comes up to them, he's like holding a bunch of snakes.
It's like, guys, I'm not being.
We do live in Tennessee here, you know? So, I mean, come on, right. It's not too far off.
I know.
No, we kid. We jest.
It is not about snake handling.
It is not about snake handling. All or if it is, it's about
more than that.
Figurative snake handling.
Right. Okay.
whatever that means.
All right.
I really liked, since you made me go first, mm-hmm. I'm going to continue that theme, and I'm going to go first.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. But I found this, I don't do a lot of Twitter, but I don't know. I've always thought about doing more, but man, I don't know. The world of Twitter is just crazy. It's craziness. And I think there's maybe more bad than good that gets accomplished with it. But this is a good thing that I found. There's a individual I follow on there named Father Matt Fish, who I believe is a Roman Catholic priest. And he said this. I thought this was good. Catholicism is not a worldview or a philosophy. Catholicism is not a worldview or a philosophy. It may give you views on the world and reasons and arguments, but it is not these things. It is Christ. It is sharing in his life, death, and resurrection. It is a mysticism, finding God in all things, as all is made subject to him. Hmm. I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
Because I think...
Put it all in a tweet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, summarize it. I think it summarizes a lot of things for me. And, I think people on the outside can look at Christianity and I'm not going to get too, like, into... I don't want to, like, draw a sharp dividing line between and say, like, Catholicism and Christianity specifically today. I just want to, like, we're both Catholics, so we're going to probably come at it with very Catholic ideas.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to say that from the outset, but I'm not going to be all like, I'm going to use Catholicism and Christianity very interchangeably today, is all I'm trying to say, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know what you're planning on doing, but
you'll see.
Oh, we'll see. Yes. But I like that. I like that little quote from Father Matt Fish because it really explodes this notion that, like, Christianity is about this, like, set of that's is just about this set of beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's really three. You know, there's really three dimensions to it. I think if you break it down, it's the creed, code, and cult. Right? There are things we believe, and there's a way we live,
mm-hmm.
And more in a moral sense. But there's also there's the cult aspect of it, right? It's a way of life, right? Not to say that Christianity or Catholicism is a cult, but to say that like it's a way of existence, and mm-hmm. and it's all centered on a person, right? A human person who's also a divine person.
Yep.
Right. And life in him, like that's the key preposition. Not just life after him or something like that, but like life in him as a present and living reality.
Yeah.
I don't know, I liked that tweet. I wanted to maybe start there from my perspective, mm-hmm. but, I want to make sure it's a back and forth too. So
yeah. Okay. I just wanted to add to that.
Yeah.
So, you know, an interesting experiment to do, like, mentally, is to say, what could you take away from something and have it essentially there? So, you know, you can remove the gray flecks in your beard. You're still John.
True.
You could shave your head. You're John. Mm-hmm. You know, clip your toenails. You're mostly pretty much still John.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, you need to think about Christianity that way or whatever phenomenon you're trying to study. But what's essential to Christianity? What if you took something away? When do you take Christianity away? I think it's just an experiment. It's not like we're trying to like reduce Christianity to something. But if you took away the resurrection,
yeah,
you don't have Christianity.
No, not at all.
You know. So if we somehow discovered tomorrow mm-hmm. that you know we discovered the dead body of Jesus in the ground, Christianity's. Is a past religion then?
Yeah. Well, and some people would argue that like you still have his teachings. There's you know something like this, but it's like, but for the Christianity that's been handed down to us, like what basically you know took over a part of the world for a long period of time, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, and continues to expand throughout the world and grow throughout the world without the resurrection. You don't have that.
Yeah, right.
Without the belief in the resurrection, you don't have that.
Yeah. There's an old joke that one of my professors used to say, and he was talking about, you know, the different, he's kind of poking fun at the different kinds of Christianity, the different, you know, denominations.
Mm-hmm.
But he's talking about what would happen, so it was sort of that thought experiment. We discovered that, you know, we found the dead body, we're 100% sure that we've just discovered the dead body of Jesus in the ground. You know, archaeologists have discovered it. And he gets to the Pope,
mm-hmm.
and the Pope, they come to the Pope and address him and say, I'm sorry, Your Holiness, but we've just made this discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you can't call me Your Holiness anymore. He takes his cross off.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, I've got to tell the people that this was all a hoax.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
It's all hinges on the resurrection. Without that, it's nothing.
Absolutely. You know, that's something like as a convert, like to Catholicism, I really, because that was always like, that was a turning point for me in my own faith. As I mentioned last time, was realizing that, you know, when I was in my early teens you're starting to have intellectual arguments with people where it's like, some people argue that all that the Christianity stuff is just a bunch of fairy tales, you know? And so as someone who loved Jesus, right, I was like, well, and was happy to be a Christian, I was like, well, wait a minute, but so is that true? And so investigating it, you know, the key issue that it really came back to for me was like, you know, all of the evidence seemed to point to the idea that Christ had risen from the dead, mm-hmm. like, right, yeah. like it was claimed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was huge for me, right? Because it's in, you know, it's indicated by St. Paul, right? You know, that if Christ is not risen, he says the same thing mm-hmm. in Scripture. He says, you know, he basically says all of this is in vain,
yeah.
right? If Christ is not risen, then all of this is in vain. I mean, that's coming mm-hmm. from, you know, St. Paul himself, one of the apostles. And you see that in the stories that are laid out in the Gospels and then in Acts of the Apostles. And just our knowledge of the early church is that it was very much driven forth by this belief that Christ had risen from the dead. It was a thing of witness, right?
Yeah.
That we saw the risen Christ, right? And we beheld him. We spent time with him. He taught us, right? Like, and gave us this mission.
Yeah.
Right.
We're handing this on.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote down people. I wrote down as one of my things, like, people of the resurrection. Like, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things of being a Christian. And, like, and so there's the notion of, like, this past event of the resurrection mm-hmm. that's important. But it's also a belief in our own resurrection, right? Like, that this world is not ultimately, and the things of this world are not ultimately, like, lost to some kind of nothingness or, you know, like, you know, like that the end of this life, whether it's the end of the world or whether it's just the end of an individual life, is not the end of that life,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
That ultimately there is a hope beyond the grave, right? And it's all based in the resurrection of Christ, because our life here now, if we are in Christ, right, we are partakers in his resurrection, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
So the idea is that, you know, Christ, the resurrected Christ reveals to us the destiny of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of the principle, the turning point, and the sort of principle for, reveals to us what, you know, our end is, our goal, God's original intention with us.
Right.
Has always been. And it discloses that we're, you know, the resurrection is sort of, you know, our destiny too.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I'm trying to find in Morning Prayer today, it was one of my favorite passages from Romans. And I want to roll this into it too. Romans chapter 8, verses 18 through 21, it says, "The sufferings of the present are as nothing compared with the glory to be revealed in us. Indeed, the whole created world eagerly awaits the revelation of the sons of God. Creation was made subject to futility, not of its own accord, but by him who once subjected it. Yet not without hope, because the world itself will be freed from its slavery to corruption and share in the glorious freedom of the children of God." I love, that's one of my favorite passages in scripture. It might be my favorite,
yeah.
Because it talks about how this, you know, some people, for some people, Christianity, even for like believers, Christianity is like, the hope is like, well, I'm going to go to heaven when I die and kind of be like this angel playing a harp, right? You know, sitting on a cloud playing a harp.
Smoking dope on the clouds.
Smoking dope on the clouds.
Which would be cool.
Maybe that's the modern. Maybe that's the modern.
That'd be cool.
The more like the Generation X version of the playing the harp on the clouds.
Yeah.
But like that's not the ultimate destiny of anything, right?
Yep.
Yes. When we die our individual death, Christians believe that we're separated from our bodies and we exist in the presence of God. Mm-hmm. You know, our spirits, our souls exist in the presence of God.
Yep. Leave this world behind.
Right.
It's all like falling away, fading away.
But in the end, right, one of the last things we profess in both versions of, in both the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed, is the resurrection of the dead or the resurrection of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So we get our body.
And the life everlasting.
And the life everlasting. Good.
No, it's just tied to that.
Yeah.
You can't separate the two.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it's not zombie. It's not zombie life. It's a, we do get our bodies back, but they're glorified bodies, much like Christ's body was glorified.
Right.
But we also see in that passage from Romans that creation itself, right, is not subject to futility. So, you know, we see the world around us decaying in different ways and going the way of the grave.
Yeah. We're feeling that.
Right. But, ourselves. And we don't know all that this entails, much of what it entails at all. We just know that this promise, right, it's a promise of that the world is not subject to it's not the final word on anything in the world either, that it's subject to this final futility,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
There is a, this world is in the process of some kind of transformation. You know, it's almost like the process of the caterpillar, you know, becoming the butterfly,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the caterpillar lives a creepy crawly life and then it dies in a way when it goes into the cocoon, right?
Yeah.
And it's gone. It's like resting there, right? And in its little grave, and then, but it emerges, right?
Yeah.
And it's this incredible natural process.
Yeah.
I think sometimes that like God gave us the caterpillar and the butterfly to just be a natural reminder of this phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right.
No, right. I mean, just to bring H.P. Lovecraft into the conversation.
All
right,
yeah. Right on. I was waiting for you.
Yeah.
I was like, when's Chris going to bring H.P. Lovecraft into the conversation?
So, yeah. I mean, I think one of the fascinating things about his sort of mythological world that he's built
mm-hmm.
is that when he tries to, at least, I mean, I've read this one story, and I read the scholarly introduction at the beginning of these things, but, you know, you should never trust anything a scholar says. That's like number
I one. Try to not read the scholarly introduction.
Yeah,
you know until, and I'll go back and read it later if it sounds interesting, but like, you know, I want to read the thing myself.
I know.
You know.
I wanted to get some context to, to his thought, and it really helped.
I hear you, yeah.
But anyway, what he does, certainly does it in the Dunwich Horror, is that when he's describing these creatures, you know, they're one of the things that fascinated Lovecraft evidently was, you know, the multiplication of dimensions that we've discovered in modern science.
Yeah.
And in modern math. And so he sees these creatures as sort of able to inhabit multiple, I mean, more than the three dimensions that we consciously inhabit ourselves.
Yeah.
And when he's trying to describe them, he wants to reach the limit of our dimensions and then sort of gesture towards it's indescribable.
But right.
Because they inhabit all this multiplicity of dimensions. Well, you know, in a way you can think about the new creation or the new heavens, new earth, the resurrected body. You get glimpses of that in the Gospels with the appearances of Jesus.
Right.
Where he, you know, passes through locked doors, et cetera. It's just the body is not limited in a ways that we're fundamentally, the way we fundamentally know the body to be in this world. It's sort of passed through the sort of limitations of the horizon of death, the limitations of our three-dimensional sort of finite reality. It's been attached to, united to eternity.
Yeah.
Which breaks these sort of boundaries in a way that it's incomprehensible. So that analogy really does help. So when we think about the sort of resurrected body, the new creation, it's like it just breaks out of the boundaries. You know, we divide things up between the material and the spiritual, but it sort of exceeds that dualism or duality.
Yeah, like it's almost like, yeah, we think of like, oh, they just need to go together, but it's like we can't, like, you know, and there's other passages that St. Paul has where he talks about like eye has not seen nor ear has heard, right? We can't really comprehend it now. Like and it's often crossed my mind that, like, you know, the language of like poetry and music is really the only way to and that's why, like, even visual art, like great visual art, right? It displays this thing that we see in our mind's eye, but we can't fully put into, we can't fully describe or make a reality, right?
Right.
Tolkien has a lot, like,
those are all the essential human things.
But we sense that it has a place, right?
Well, those are all the most important things, that way. The most deeply human things.
Well, and that's why it'll be fun when we talk about Tolkien's, like, On Fairy Stories and some of the other stuff he wrote eventually. Is because he had some very interesting thoughts on these things that informed a lot of what he was doing with Middle Earth. The resurrection is just foundational, and it's foundational in so many ways. It's foundational not just from a, not just from a belief standpoint, but from a an attitude and a mysticism, like kind of an attitude towards the world that tends to this resurrection sort of mysticism, right? That this world, although it's passing away in all of the apparent ways, that it's not subject to this, like, futility, right? That all things are meant to have this ultimate flourishing and beauty and wonder and lasting life.
Yeah. Glory is how we encapsulate
that's the word.
Yep.
Glory.
Mm-hmm.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I also wrote down here, people of the incarnation. People of the incarnation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think a Christian has got to be understand that the incarnation is huge. And the incarnation was not something I thought a lot about for a long time, really until I started down the path of Catholicism. I feel like, and I know this is like, for any Protestants listening, I'm certainly not trying to, say that Protestants don't believe in the incarnation. But I feel like it was just not something that was like a thing in focus a lot for me when I was in the circles I ran in.
Yeah.
This note, like, just the mystery of God becoming man.
Yeah.
And everything that entails. It's much more in focus in, I guess, you know, in Catholicism and in Eastern Orthodoxy, it seems like.
Yeah, the sacramental dimension.
Yeah.
The liturgical, the symbolic,
and I think it has. It, it's it's important because it reminds us, it gets into this idea of, I think it's the right term, Ed. I always get these two terms mixed up, and one's bad and one's good. Divinization, right? Divination is bad. Divination is where you're doing like, magic. You know, magic and stuff like that. You know, you're trying to talk to the dead, basically.
Yeah.
Divinization is good. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's what Christians are called to, right? Mm-hmm. To enter more deeply into the life of God and the notion that we actually share in the most intimate form of the life of God through Jesus, right?
Yeah, we're joined.
Through our, through the sacramental life we have in Jesus.
Yeah.
That we are actually, if God is this trinity of persons, right? This perfect communion, right? That we are, through Jesus, in our communion with Jesus, we become drawn into the communion of the Holy Trinity, right? And so that leads us, if Christ was God and they became man, we are man and then must become God. Now, we're not God in the sense of like we're going to actually become like a fourth person of the Trinity or something like that, but like, but right. that we actually are so intimately
partakers
united with Christ
that
we
nature.
Partake.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which is a quotation from the New Testament.
Yeah.
From the second letter of Peter. Partakers of the divine nature.
I'm not sure which one, but yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Sort of the way he describes it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've heard this brought up by other people, but like, you know, so when we were in like in high school, there was the song by Joan Osborne that was like, "What if God was one
yes.
of us?" Right.
Yeah.
And
just a slob like one. No.
And
a snob. I don't know.
And you know, I don't think I thought of this for the first like, you know, couple of years after I'd heard that song, but then I was like, "Oh yeah, like, well, he kind of did become one." Like, that's the whole idea of Christianity, right?
Right.
that's the whole view of Christianity.
Yeah.
That God became one of us, and but that's it's an interesting song because it portrays the. That this is maybe a perennial longing or idea that people have come up with, you know, that maybe is, and I know that there were, you know, there were stories of gods becoming men before, before like the time of, you know, before the time of Christ, not necessarily historical stories, but like myths and that kind of thing. So this is not something that's like, just totally foreign to the heart of man, right? Of mankind.
Mm-hmm. We were just talking about those aspects of our human experience and nature that are the most essential and they're the most difficult to describe.
Mm-hmm.
We sense that they're higher and deeper, you know, like love, freedom, justice, things like even like evil. And suffering speaks, you know, it's such a difficult thing to grasp because, you know, there's this part of ourselves that we sense or feel that's more worth more, that's valuable or invaluable. Like, you know, suffering and pain and those things, sort of disclose to us in a negative way, something higher and deeper that that poetry and song and story can kind of, you know, reach.
Yeah.
And then ritual can kind of really get us closest to, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I was going there. I had something, there was a step there I was taking.
It was awesome. And then,
there was a step to something that was really a, like big deal. And it's
then,
gone.
And then the UFO froze you in this tractor beam.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a step there.
Well, I think you brought it back to like creativity and music and poetry and art and those sorts of things. And all these things, there's a key word and it's mystery, right?
Yeah.
The resurrection, the incarnation, the Trinity, these are mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And the Christianity is a fundamentally, foundationally mysterious faith.
Mm-hmm.
There's this understanding that reason can only take you so far, like natural human reason, your ability to explore kind of on an empirical level, right? And even to just kind of logically, intellectually fathom things, that at some point you have to surrender all of who you are to the mystery of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
not to say that the mystery is irrational.
No, not to say that. And that's a very important point because we're not claiming that it's just it can't possibly make any sense. We're claiming that it's just, it's almost too wonderful. It's like when you take a bite of like a really rich chocolate cake or something like that, and you're just like, you're overwhelmed by it, you know?
Yeah.
And on a sensory level, and you're just like, I can't eat any more of this for right now because I'm just kind of overwhelmed by how delicious it all is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's like what happens on a spiritual level and an intellectual level with many of these things.
Right. Yeah.
These are mysteries which kind of can only be come to you by grace, right? Mm-hmm. at some point you depart from the ability of your will to kind of like, you know, explore, and you just have to kind of surrender yourself to it. Excuse me, need to clear my throat. Let me clear my throat. You just have to surrender yourself to the wonder and the beauty of it all, and trust that God will illuminate you, right? Trust in the illumination of grace.
Mm-hmm. Nope, that's right. I think it's So you're sort of awakened to, you know, you come to the realization, and this is why Christianity, you know, something smacks of truth and value if it reveals something to you about yourself that's like more than you could have understood otherwise. And with Christianity, it's like, you know, these mysteries at the heart of the faith, incarnation, Trinity, sort of our you know, normal reasoning intellect sort of starts to fracture.
Yeah.
You know, we get lost in conundrums and like, you know, three in one, you know, God becoming man, being fully God, fully divine. These things are sort of, you know, technically speaking, antinomies. They're sort of contradictions that you have to hold together.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can get to the truth of things is if you hold these two things that you can't reconcile together. And then from there, you're kind of catapulted into, you know, for lack of a better word, the mystery. And and again, what we're saying by the word mystery is it's not something that's unintelligible or irrational, but so immersed, you're being immersed in the ocean of reason itself.
Yeah.
And you're only getting a fragment of it, but the whole's right there in the fragment, and it's never ending.
Yeah. This brings to mind, I was on the interwebs yesterday, and there was an ad for some kind of, I don't know what it was. It was some, you know, educational institution or something like that. And the tagline for this place I really liked. It was, truth is beautiful. And that popped to mind when you were talking right now, because I think sometimes the intellect, we're in search of truth in an isolated fashion, right? We want to, you know, especially in modern sense, we want to be like, you know, we want to be like objective, you know, objectively figuring things out, right? And we lose, it's like we lose sight that like this truth that we're trying to explore is fundamentally beautiful, and it goes along with this beauty that overwhelms the senses, and it's also good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good beyond like, you know, our ability to kind of like contain all of its goodness, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like there's something in that notion too, that like, you know, the three transcendentals, you know, emanate from these ideas, right? From
truth, goodness, and
from
beauty.
These realities, really. I like the word reality there better than ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it's not just some intellectual thing. It's an exploration of this hidden reality that's hidden to our senses, right?
Yeah. I think one of the most basic things you can say, the most really a wonderful statement, is to say something like, you know, Jesus Christ reveals to us at the same time who God is and who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And that in joining the two, you know, he makes our purpose evident to us, our calling, our vocation, our end, our goal, what it really means to be human on this earth.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, to be all that we are, to have all our longings and desires and hopes and pains and the whole human thing all wrapped up. Jesus reveals that to us most fully.
Yeah.
And he does that because he's fully God. So
right.
You know, that's the idea of mystery again.
Yes.
That the two are, you know, called to be joined.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, I mean, it's really about this Jesus character, right? Like that he is the focus. So we don't just have this like belief in some abstract distant God, but that it's like that it's this,
yeah,
it's this historical figure who is also God,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and that something happened on Easter Sunday.
It's God,
first Easter.
It's God from down the street, right? It's yeah. It's I wrote this like kind of meditation on that part of it like a few years ago, where it's just like, I'll have to dig it up, and it was basically like, you know, who's God? He's this kid Josh down the street, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's this kid that lives down the street, right? Now, and you know, for if you were living in Palestine in the first century, he was right down the street. But
yeah.
But in a sense, like, think about it that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he is God, like he is the one behind all of creation, right? He is the you know, he is the reality behind reality,
mm-hmm.
right? But he's also this kid that lives down the street, this mm-hmm. guy that lives down the street from you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he entered in, you know, that entered into our reality. So, well, I have some other ideas here. I want to maybe explore a little bit. Maybe we won't get to all of them today. I don't know why that came out the way it did, but it like auto-corrected me to the wrong word. But you mentioned suffering earlier, and like all of these ideas, you know, all of these things we've been talking about, these realities, these mysteries are wonderful to ponder, but we deal with this thing in this world of suffering and of the reality of evil and of this sadness and difficulty and problems that go against our happiness, and mm-hmm. they make us wonder, and like what's really, like what is going on? It seems to, on a surface level, it seems to strike against the very notion of good, of like goodness of God, the goodness, truth,
ultimate
beauty,
goodness,
right?
Yeah.
One of the things I wrote down here is mercy until it hurts, and I think this is important because
why does it say hearts?
That's what I was saying. It autocorrected the hearts,
right. Okay.
Right? Which kind of that sounds play, like,
yeah,
some kind of like, you know, it sounds like some kind of clever slogan on you know, on some like church billboard or something like that, you know, church the in front of
right?
church.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Today's sermon, mercy until it hurts.
Copyright 2019, John Carswell.
All come right. on, come on.
So yeah, but mercy until it hurts. I think it's really important to call out mercy because there is, at some point, I want to do an episode specifically on the Christian's attitude towards his enemies, in quotation marks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that a Christian can like have no enemies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that that's an aspect of Christianity that's not explored enough, that's not expounded upon enough, right? And that's not even prayed for enough, like that we just love our enemies, right?
Yeah.
And because mercy is foundational. Mercy is this realization that we do, as cliche as it's become, we live in a broken world, and
mm-hmm.
that some things just don't seem to add up. And, you know, we sense this goodness when we're with family and we're with friends and, you know, or we're just enjoying something that's really good, you know, enjoying a good meal. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't take much to remind you that there's also a lot of ugliness and difficulty and hardship in the world.
Yeah.
And so how does the Christian respond to that?
Well, and it looks like that stuff rules.
It does.
That stuff is in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And it does rule our experience. The brokenness sort of, you know, rules. And we're kind of left wondering, you know, do these deeper, higher, more wonderful things that we sense to be, we long to have permanent value, like our, you know, love, you know, our friendships, our relationships, et cetera, or the beauty of Messiaen's, you know, praise to the eternity of Jesus, which I hope we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
Those, you know, we're hoping, longing those things will last. And that, you know, I think it's out of Christianity that helps us sort of, gives us that hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it, like you said, it ties to every single thing of worth and value in our world, and nothing is ultimately lost. It's all redeemed. If it's good, it's permanent.
Yeah.
You know, it's lasting.
Right.
And the resurrection discloses that.
Absolutely.
And that's sort of, that's where we're at with Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And mercy is a practice, right? Mercy mm-hmm. is a practice that the Christian, and an attitude that the Christian is called to have in the world. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, we've heard, it's been a huge theme for you know, for Pope Francis. A couple of years ago, they had the Year of Mercy, and so it obviously and so we could probably do multiple episodes on what mercy is.
Yeah,
because it when we're talking about this term, it does beg the question. But there, because there is the whole question of mercy and justice and those sorts of things. But it on a very like simple level, the Christian is called to become a merciful person and to really explore what that truly means, mm-hmm. right? To be yeah. to have an attitude of mercy. There's this theme running through Christianity and the teachings of Christ and the teachings of the apostles that you don't get to heaven if you're not a merciful person yourself, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That if you're not, if you don't learn the lessons of mercy,
mm-hmm.
then you're not worthy of the kingdom of God,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
In a very strong way,
right? Yeah, and the question why? Mm-hmm. Why be merciful? Why?
Right.
Why, you know, Christ is teaching us, you know, love your enemies, turn your cheek, go the extra mile, etc. Why be like that? And, you know, I think it's important for Christians like ourselves to always, you know, try to comprehend that because it takes you back to the sort of the whole story.
Right.
And that's easy to get lost. Like we were talking about, you know, it's easy. These sort of caricatures start to happen, you know, where Christianity is about escaping earth and going to heaven, smoking dope in the clouds or whatever.
Yeah.
With a really cool golden harp. You know, it's about, you know, a moral, you know, a morality that's, mm-hmm. that's maybe constraining or, you know, pointless or, you know, it's like hurts people, like, you know, the sexual ethic of Christianity.
Right.
Or, you know, about, you know, the needy and the suffering, like, you know, becoming needy and suffering yourself for others. But, you know, and I think it's important. Maybe we can talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Yeah.
What
do I want to say?
What's that?
Should I just say what I want to say?
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right.
Say it, man.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, so what we're just saying, our experience tells us that to get ahead in the world, to get, you know, is to take care of yourself at the expense of others.
Oh yeah.
And that's the sort of, don't be merciful, be cruel. Mm-hmm. You know, even if we don't say that.
Dog eat dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And dude, my life is full of that all day.
Yeah.
You know, the world of,
Chris has a big dog. That's what he's trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, our experience says to, you know, be in charge, to do something that's good for you,
uh-huh.
to do something that benefits you, you have to do it at the expense of others.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like mercy is the opposite of.
Right.
But what Christ teaches is, you know, that actually the one who's actually in charge, who's really ruling, is the least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one who does give mercy to someone, you know, in need. You know, the act of giving a cold cup of water to, you know, someone who's thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually, that's like a piece of the true way of ruling the world.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And
because it's focused on a belief in the things that will last, right?
Those are exactly. Those are the lasting things.
You know, and it's also this notion that Christ, at the center of it all, we have the icon of Christ on the cross coming despite the fact that he's God, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He literally created all this stuff. He literally owns everything,
yeah.
right? And knows everything and mm-hmm. and is all powerful. And what does he do? He comes into the world and he serves to the point of death, right? He gives his life to the point of, for others, to the point of dying and not just dying, but dying in a really horrible way.
Yeah.
And
the one who's in charge in that moment. So you have like, you know, you have Christ on the cross dying in agony.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have beside him, he's guarded by soldiers who have the power of violence. And they're, you know, they're serving the power, you know, the supreme power in the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, Caesar, who rules by violence.
Right.
And Christianity turns all that upside down and says the one who's truly ruling right now is mm-hmm. the one who is just, you know, side was just opened up by that spear.
Yeah.
And the blood and water poured out. That's the one, that's the throne. The
yeah.
cross is the true throne. The throne of Caesar is a sham.
Right. Yeah.
And it's absurd.
And that's almost like another mystery at the heart of the faith, right? Is the mystery of the crucified Christ, right? That
yeah.
that he is still king, right?
And he's showing us the true the true way to rule.
Right.
And actually, God's original intention for human beings was to rule with him.
Right.
Rule over this world he created. That's why he made us his, that's what it means to be the divine image.
Right.
Is to be sort of sharing in his rule and his authority.
But a merciful and benevolent rule. Exactly. Not the rule of, like you said, Caesar, right? You know, where it's this rule at the edge of the sword.
Those are the temptations that Christ faced in the desert.
Yeah.
During the temptation moment. That's the temptation, the original temptation of Adam and Eve, was to choose to understand what good and evil is on their own terms.
Right.
That's the grasping of the fruit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of determining to do it, to trust in God's way of that what he says is the right path. And he has to kind of come and show and demonstrate that and be that for us, as us and with us. And then we're these Christians struggling to sort of do that. And it's like near impossible.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're kind of our best saints, the holiest people we can produce as Christians, like Mother Teresa, you know, there's a long list of these people, but they sort of disclose to us what that really looks like.
Yeah, well, Mother Teresa is the one that's always brought up in a contemporary context because she is so, like, you know, I mean, she was, even people who, like, she's this tiny little woman who, you know, just, I mean, she looks like kind of, you're kind of like typical, old, you know, old lady, right? You know, does not appear to be powerful in any sense of the word.
Yeah.
And, but just even people who like spent time around her talk about, you know, that there was just this like strange power that emanated from her. Like in a good way, like in a forceful, like calling you to be a better person, like that would emanate from her.
Yeah.
And, I guess it's just the light of holiness, right? That we're ultimately talking about. Mm-hmm. All these ideas wrapped up into one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, what did she do? She went in and served the poorest of the poor that nobody else wanted to serve, and somehow she becomes not. Now she receives some worldly recognition because of that, but that's not necessarily to say that everything else she did, you know, that there's. You know, that was what she was focused on necessarily. Like that was, that almost happened to be a byproduct of everything good.
Yeah.
That she
Which
did.
Is not a negative thing.
It's not like, you
know, we want to exalt, you know, recognize and exalt those things. And
right.
Actually, that actually happened in the world means,
well,
wow,
and I think it speaks to the prophetic power of who she was, right? That people recognize
that,
like there's something amazing in this person, right?
Yeah.
Something that defies our normal logic of the world. Maybe this needs to be a two-part episode because we got some other things here that I definitely want to explore and,
cool.
you know, some other ideas, but, you know, we got to talk about sacraments at some point because I think they are very, very important. There's some other ideas I've written here that I want to,
I interviewed my son. Let's do this next time. We got to talk some music. We got to do some other stuff. Do you want to do that? You want me to do that now or next time? I could do either. I interviewed my 7-year-old
to hear what he had to say about,
I asked him the
what
question.
What it means to be a Christian.
Hey, man, let's go in the backyard, sit on these chairs.
Well, how long is it?
7 or 8 minutes. No, 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe we start off with that next time.
Okay, cool.
Maybe we'll start off with that for the next episode.
Yeah.
That could be cool.
Yeah.
All right. So, but yeah, we'll do a second part on this topic. Look for that.
Save wiggle for next time.
Right on. We're going to talk about, you wanted to talk about, you made a choice with music this week.
Yeah, man.
You wanted to talk about the Quartet for the End of Time by Olivier Messiaen. Is that how you say his name?
Close.
Did I get it right?
No.
No, okay.
You're close, though, man. Olivier Messiaen.
Olivier Messiaen.
Yeah, you gotta be French. You gotta be Francophile.
Look, man, this is Tennessee. I'm from the South. All right, yeah. Oliver Messiaen.
yeah, Messiaen.
Messiaen.
Yeah. So
I should have known that he's French. I should have given the French pronunciation to him.
Pronunciation.
Pronunciation. That's how I instead of pronunciation, I say pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, I wanted to talk about this because I thought it would go well with our episode of what it means to be a Christian. Messiaen. Just a bit about him. I mean, I'm not an expert at all on classical, you know, type music, but he was sort of one of the great original, like, modernist classical musicians.
Right.
He was, you know, at the beginning of serialism and sort of the really progressive avant-garde type music.
Yeah.
At the same time, he was deeply Catholic, deeply religious person.
Wow.
He was a genius. He, I don't know if you could say suffered from, but he had the gift of or suffered from synesthesia, where you see the colors of sounds.
Right.
So which, there's a mixture of vision, which and is, feeling and hearing.
Which is a fascinating phenomenon in of itself, yeah. Like because I feel like that's a little phenomenon that happens in some people that points to these greater like hidden realities, mm-hmm. right? You know, that people will actually hear certain sounds and mm-hmm. and especially like harmony, like musical harmony.
Yeah.
And it'll visually manifest itself in some way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's some kind of just fascinating mystery there yeah. That has an eschatological dimension to it. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. So as an artist, Messiaen is sort of, there's a sort of, if there's a sanctity of that gift of art, mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's something with him there,
yeah.
you know, there's something otherworldly about this guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the great, great music does that, you know, like Pale or Sailor, but
yes, well, that's who first comes to mind. Yes,
but anyway, Messiaen wrote this quartet for the end of time. So he was captured. He was in the French army, World War II,
mm-hmm.
captured by the Germans. I forget what he was doing. I think it was 1940 or 41.
Okay,
and in the camp, in the prison camp, they had some instruments.
Okay,
they had a piano.
Mm-hmm.
They had a I think it's a clarinet. They had a violin and a cello. They were kind of broken instruments. It's in the winter.
Yeah.
But he and three other musicians, he wrote this quartet for the end of time. In the camp, he read or reread the Apocalypse, the last book of the Bible,
yeah.
the Book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can imagine being in this experience, you know, World War II.
It probably seemed like the world was ending.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it sort of gestures to that great moment and
right.
like the chaos, the devolution of culture and society, of all the terror and suffering.
The four horsemen of the apocalypse, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, they wrote this, performed it in the camp.
Yeah.
And it's probably his most important piece. And I mean, his music, he wrote an opera, St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah.
He wrote, you know, tons and tons of pieces of music, most of which are organ work. He was a great organist.
Uh-huh.
He wrote a bunch of music, like 20 regards on, you know, I think the Child Jesus.
Yeah.
Just deeply religious themes.
I read in his Wikipedia article, it talks about how he was very inspired by Bryce Canyon in Utah.
Yeah, yeah, he did write
uh-huh. Which I've been to, so that mm-hmm. was cool to read. I was yeah. like, I understand that.
Yeah.
It's a crazy looking place. We'll link to that in the show notes so you can kind of get an idea.
He went
of what
there. He was
like.
Commissioned to do something for
yeah.
Some sort of American themed music, and he wrote, I forget the name of the piece. He was also fascinated by birdsong.
Yeah.
He transcribed birdsong, and he's got like, you know, a catalog of bird songs that he transcribed to music.
That's awesome. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
he thought he
like transcribed bird songs.
Talk about like the Christian and very Catholic kind of sensibility that sees the natural world as sort uh-huh. of symbolic of the higher world.
Yeah.
He saw birds in that way.
Yeah.
It sort of reflected the angelic, you know. And anyway, he wrote this quartet for the end of time. But I thought, you know, which we were kind of thinking about and talking about this episode, I thought, let's play one of these pieces from this.
And yeah.
It's an 8-part piece. It takes about 50 minutes to perform. And there's actually, just to mention this, because I watched it this week, there's a 35 or so minute documentary you can find online for free.
Oh, wow.
I forget who the guy who put it together, but it's a nice documentary that explains the piece and has a musician kind of talking about what the music means to her.
Right. You know?
But it's intelligent it's worth watching just to get a sense of the whole piece, because you know, we can't play the whole thing or even parts from more than one piece of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let me play a little snippet of this is movement 5, which is the praise for the eternity of Jesus. Is that right?
Louange à l'éternité de Jésus.
Oh man.
Praise to the eternity of Jesus.
Breaking out
man.
French pronunciation.
All that work,
man.
I did back in school.
Here we go.
Yeah, so we have the cello playing, and the piano is about to come in. And the whole Quartet for the End of Time is about the meeting of time and eternity.
Mm.
So time running into eternity, and you know, it's a cataclysmic type sense. So in the first four movements, you have the first part, the crystal liturgy,
yeah,
sort of an angelic type liturgical thing, and then you have the angel announcing the end of time, which is very cacophonic and modernist feeling,
right?
And it sort of progresses through these stages. Has an interlude, and then it has this first praise to the eternity of Jesus.
Mm.
And you have this sort of juxtaposition between the cacophony of the end of time with the sort of transcendent, singular repetition of a single chord there on the piano, basically, and sort of the sort of slow movement of the cello that sort of wants to evoke the other side of time, what's on the other side of time.
Wow.
And so it's a moment of stillness and unification.
Yeah.
Focused on Christ.
Well, and you know, with Christ, this movement is called Praise to the Eternity of Jesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the incarnation earlier, and Christ, the second eternal person of the Holy Trinity, becomes a man, right? Takes on a human nature. And the form of this very still and small reality of a child, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the one of the fascinating aspects of the Christian mysteries for me has always been, or in the last few years, has been this reality that God becomes God, who's all powerful, becomes man, and often manifests himself in very quiet ways, in very small and quiet ways. I'm gonna take this down a little bit. We'll absolutely, you know, we've got our playlist that we've been creating for Red Lamp District, which will be available, and we'll always be adding to. So that and maybe another movement from this will be incorporated into that playlist. So you can go check out the whole thing there
on Spotify.
I love the notion that he wrote this while basically in a prisoner of war camp, right? Mm-hmm. And for them to perform. So it's in a way he's entering into all this music is a product of him entering into not only he enters into the mystery and the horror of suffering here, right? And being in this prison camp during this horrible conflagration, this horrible war, but he's processing it all through the lens of divine revelation and specifically the apocalypse, right?
Yeah.
This very mysterious work of God. Right?
He's doing the properly Christian thing, I think, of interpreting, understanding his experience,
yes,
through the sort of big story,
uh-huh,
of creation and redemption.
Right.
And
and that's something I wanted to, and we'll explore this more next week. That's something I wanted to, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something I wanted to mention is, like, I feel like in all of this, there's this dimension of seeing, right? That, like, what do all these mysteries have to do with anything when the way we live our lives? We are called to have this different vision of the world and of reality, and to begin to see the world in a different light than what is maybe natural to us, in the sense of what we're of how we maybe would see it with just born into it, right?
Yeah.
That we're called to see this world in a redemptive and an incarnational light, that it despite the things that may be problematic, that you know, that there's this light that Christ sheds on everything, that we have to begin to see things by, right?
Mm-hmm. And therefore to live by,
yeah,
right?
Yep, yep, that seeing and that comprehending becomes,
yeah,
transforms us into living life in a different way.
Yeah, if we can see and feel and know that, you know, what that charity will rule,
mm-hmm,
all in all, you know, that charity is what rules above all, not force or violence or power or, you know, self-interest, but actually self-giving, self-serving, not self-serving, self-sacrifice.
Right.
if we can sort of put that in the forefront of our minds and live as if that were the most true thing, you know, I think my life would be very different. I feel like most of the time that's there,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of, you know, at worst compartmentalized, you know, I believe it's true, but man, it's hard to sort of, hold on to it
mm-hmm.
when, you know, other voices, other, you know, yeah, other voices are sort of saying something different.
Yeah. Yeah. The practice of it is not an easy thing. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to somebody like Mother Teresa, that maybe is the virtue of a radical decision to, within a Christian faith, to say, like, I'm leaving everything behind and I am just going to follow Christ in a very radical way, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And there's the there's the truth and the reality that not everybody is called to be Mother Teresa and to, like, you know, and to live that way. But that's a topic for another episode. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, the kind of called to just completely change who you are versus kind of being rooted where you already are, but still following Christ in a very, in what externally might seem like a very normal way.
Yeah.
Right.
But
when you take a closer look, maybe very different from how other people in that same situation might live their lives.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like yeast works through dough.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of like what we're meant to be like. Mm-hmm. Supposed to make really good music. You know, mm-hmm. really fun, exciting, and emotionally moving podcasts, like today.
Oh, yes, like today.
And we're supposed to, like, you know, raise our children, you know, do our jobs,
mm-hmm.
you know, live the sort of banal things that, well.
In the light of Christ, right? And to transform them in the light of Christ. It's a continuing mission.
Have mercy.
Great. Yeah. Let the Lord have mercy, like, in all things, right? And even that word mercy means so much more than maybe what we first comes to mind, you know, that maybe that's a very foundational prayer for the Christian life, daily prayer for the Christian life. It's just, Lord have mercy, right? Very easy one to pray in just about any situation. All right. Well, speaking of mundane things, I have to, you have to get to work. I mm-hmm. have to, take my car in for, mundane maintenance and therefore this podcast episode must come to an end.
Man. All right.
So, Lord have mercy on your job and mm-hmm. on my car. So
yeah. Hopefully it'll keep running for a while.
Yes, I hope so. It's, mm-hmm. I have my doubts sometimes this particular car is,
is it an antique yet or? What year is that?
It's a 2003, I think.
Okay.
So
my car is too.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll.
You got a few years, and it's an antique. You'll never have to buy a license plate again. I think you just buy one.
Yeah.
Keep that thing around, nice. Man.
Yeah, man. Well, I hope I can. I mean, I need a car ultimately that functions. So that's the real question. But
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Hey, check out. Make sure you check out the show notes for lots of cool links about some of the stuff we talked about, and maybe some other stuff beyond that. Hmm. And I think we're going to continue this conversation on what it means to be a Christian next week.
Like it.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, John.
All right. We'll talk at you next time, everybody. Bye.